A lonely vegetarian sweep you off your feet like a maid marrying, having fun like a seminary in a wait. You say you're a happy Unitarian laughing in the wind like an old Bulgarian. Hey, by the way, are you a librarian? Oh,
yes, we are librarians. And you're listening to the Mount Kisco Public Library Podcast. I'm Deirdre.
And I'm Maria. And today we are interviewing John Scovron, author of Struts and Frets,
whose new book, Misfit, will be coming out this summer.
Hello.
Hi, hello. John.
How's it going, ladies?
Good. How are you?
I'm great.
We understand that Struts and Frets is your first book, right? First published novel, I mean? Or did you write a lot of novels before you got that one published?
Well, yeah. I think most writers have what they would call a trunk novel, or two, or three, or more.
Wow.
I definitely have two completed novels that will never see the light of day.
Are we sure about this?
Oh, yeah. I didn't go to grad school for writing. And some people do, and that's fantastic. I did not. I was pretty much done with academia. And so I had to learn some way. And those first two books were really me figuring out what I was doing. And that's not what I was thinking at the time. I was like, oh, this is brilliant. You know, someone's going to publish this for sure. But in retrospect, it was more just me trying things out. And they're very contrasting styles. The first thing I wrote was this kind of really high concept science fiction satire thing. Oh, man. It was very self-aware. But, you know, I learned a lot by writing it. And the second book had a flawed concept. And no matter what I did to it, it just didn't work out. So I was actually coming off of that second one and really kind of bummed out when my agent at the time was like, you know, have you considered writing young adult? And I was like, you know, like Gary Paulsen or something? Like, what are you talking about? Because I couldn't stand Gary Paulsen as a kid. I mean, I'm sure he's a great guy, but, you know, that alpha male, like, hey, let's go out in the woods and be men kind of, it just didn't, I couldn't relate. But then I picked up a bunch of stuff. Like, I picked up some Holly Black and Gabriel Zevin. I checked out a bunch of YA books from the library and just literally read a stack of them in, like, the space of a month. And I was like, oh, yeah, I can totally do this. And then a couple months went by, and I was working on other things. And it was late at night and, like, 2 a.m, and I had my infant son. And I was, like, feeding him a bottle. And all of a sudden, I got the initial inspiration for Struts and Frets. Just kind of came out, I guess. So yeah, your original question.
the original question was... Along the lines of, did you always want to be a writer?
Oh, wow. Well, I always wrote things. I always wrote things down. I always wrote stories or journals or diaries. I was always writing something. Even when I was convinced I was going to be an actor, I still kept a pretty meticulous journal. It didn't occur to me until after I graduated from college, I guess, that, hey, you know, I could actually like do this for a living. I don't know why it took so long to occur to me, but I've talked to other writers who had the same sort of experience. We kind of grew up with writers. It was hard to even remember that they were actual people. It was kind of like these ivory tower sort of. I remember when I was in college, I went to Carnegie Mellon in Pittsburgh and a big computer science program there. And Douglas Adams came and spoke. He was supposed to be speaking about virtual reality and artificial intelligence. But in fact, he spent most of it talking about his endangered wildlife book, Last Chance to See. I don't know if you guys have read that one. It's his only nonfiction book.
Interesting. I'm going to look that one up.
Stunning. Basically, he and a couple of people go around the world trying to find these animals that may or may not be extinct, that they don't really know. They haven't been seen in something like 10 years. And so they're wondering, you know, do they even still exist? And some of them they discovered probably didn't anymore. But it's a really wonderful book. But that was my first time seeing Douglas Adams and seeing kind of, because I always kind of imagined him to be this small, shy, reclusive British guy. But in fact, he's really just a wonderful showman and a really tall guy, big, gregarious guy who just kind of takes over a room. I mean, he was absolutely incredible to watch. And that was kind of when I first began to think, wow, I don't know, maybe I could do that. But even then, it took a long time to kind of settle in. And it took a certain amount of desperation with my situation at the time as an actor before I finally was like, you know what? I'm just going to do that. So, yes. So I don't think I always wanted to be a writer, but I always did write. Which at the end of the day is what you should be doing anyway. You know, I mean, some people, I think, get kind of caught up in, oh, I'm a writer, and what does a writer do, and all this stuff. And, well, a writer just writes. That's, it's a verb, not a noun, really, in the end.
Interesting.
That is interesting. All right, so on to the next question. Can you explain a little bit about your writing process? Do you outline, or do you let things flow?
It changes so much. I think every project is a little different. I'm definitely coming from the place of just kind of banging out a first draft. I'm reading a book right now by Anne, oh, what's her last name? She wrote Bird by Bird. She's kind of like a sassy, angry, dreadlocked Robert Fulghum sort of woman. So she talks about writing, she doesn't use this word, but I'll say sucky first drafts. Because for me anyway, it's kind of like just throwing out a sketch. I love watching cartoonists work, and they kind of draw the vague outline of the form of the body, you know, and then they go back in and kind of go over it, and each time bring in more detail and more nuance to it until we finally have this awesome picture. And that's kind of how I write. The first draft, I just kind of throw it out there and make a lot of wrong turns and, you know, end up in cul-de-sacs, just bad neighborhoods I shouldn't have been in. But eventually I find my way to the end. And the trick is not to get caught up along the way, but to really just kind of bang it out and then go back and fix it. And I know other authors that are very, very different, like David Levithan. He claims that he pretty much writes it all in his head so that when he actually sits down and types it, it's pretty much word for word. Like, he doesn't go back and do a lot of revisions. Whereas John Green, on the other hand, says that he throws away roughly 75% of what he writes in his first draft. Throws it away. Wow. It's garbage or whatever, he says. So, and these are two guys that co-wrote a book, and they have obviously very different styles kind of coming together. Which,
yeah.
That's a lot of words to keep in your head, though. I'm just thinking of David Levithan.
How does he do any? That man is amazing. I don't know how he accomplishes half of what he accomplishes.
But on the other hand, your experience as an actor, you must be used to keeping reams and reams of words in your head, right?
Well, yes and no. I could never remember them past the close of the show.
Okay.
Literally, the day after show closed, I couldn't tell you a single line from the play. I don't know why. It just was kind of one of these things that you have to make room, I guess, for the next one. You know, clear the cash, I guess, or something. I don't know. Yeah. And I'm still kind of that way with a lot of things. My day job, I write user guides for a school system, a public school system here in Maryland. And, you know, people always expect that since I wrote the user guide about something that I know everything there is to know about it. And I did when I wrote the guide, but a week after I'd written the guide, I couldn't tell anything about it.
That's so interesting. But you make acting sound a bit like simultaneous translation, because if you do know more than one language, you end up in this situation sometimes where there's like three different languages going on around you. You know what I mean, Maria?
Sometimes, yes.
Yeah.
So how does that relate to acting, though?
Basically, if you are translating, you sometimes can't really understand what you're saying.
You're accurate.
You're getting the words out, but you have to kind of step back and think about it, depending on how fast you're going.
Well, you could say that pretty much about any sort of creative art form, that there's a kind of an element of flow to it.
Right, yes.
When you kind of lose yourself, when the self recedes, and you become almost a conduit for whatever inspiration, wherever that's coming.
Yes, I think so. I think that makes sense.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah, let's go with that.
So, are any of your characters based on real people?
Well, in a sense, yes. Yeah. The short answer is yes. The long and rambling answer is that in some ways, every character is an aspect of me. We're all so multifaceted, and John Green has this great concept of remembering that everyone else around you is as multifaceted as you. It's a really cool thing that he said, but we all have millions of people inside of us, and I know it sounds crazy, but it's true. I mean, we all have so many different aspects of ourselves that we don't even always understand. So in that sense, they're all me. But on the other hand, I definitely draw inspiration from other people around you. I don't see how you couldn't. I think pretty much anyone who is good friends with a writer has to just understand that they are going to be appropriated at some point. It's just a matter of time and the right project. That said, when Struts and Frets first came out, there's a mother character in the book who is a therapist, and she's, I don't know if she's an alcoholic, but she's definitely, like, drinks a little too much wine. And my mother calls me up, and the first thing she says, I'm not an alcoholic. And I said, well, Ma, it's not, I know you're not, you know, it's fiction, but my mother's a therapist, so that aspect of it she identified with and said, oh, that's me. But it wasn't just her. It was her combined with some other people that I know. You know, one of my best friends was like, why did you make me gay in the book? And I'm like, well, it's not really you. It's, you know, a fictional character. Oh, so I'm the other friend? No. There's not a one-for-one translation here. There were aspects of him in that character, absolutely, and he saw those aspects. He did play in a band with me in high school, and he was a terrible bass player. That part was true, but there were a lot of other parts that were somebody else or somebody I made up completely, you know? And then the other thing is that I like to play around with what-if scenarios, and I think to a certain extent, all writing is a bit of a what-if scenario. And a big part of writing Struts and Frets for me was my own grandfather was a musician, pianist, and I looked up to him enormously. And he decided not to become a professional musician and instead to go on to dentistry. And I've always wondered what he would have been like had he decided to be a musician instead, what my family would have been like had he decided to be a musician. And so a lot of Struts and Frets is me playing around with this kind of alternate reality concept of, you know, the sliding doors, you know, that Gwyneth Paltrow movie where it's just like one tiny little thing kind of just totally send you down a different path. So getting back to, once again, the original question. Yes, absolutely everyone in there is based on real people, but it's seen through so many different filters, and I've turned it around so much that I don't think you could really translate it easily, if that makes sense.
It does, and I think actually it makes the book so applicable because there's aspects of people who are reading.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Which is a weird thing.
So I was just thinking about how some of our favorite writers have done other things, the way you have acted, and there's screenwriters and lawyers, and people do all sorts of different things, and we have kind of codified that lawyers write amazing plots. Not that other people don't, but we can visualize really clearly scenes that our screenwriter friend writes in her novels.
Right.
And do you think that your writing is at all influenced by your time on the stage?
Oh, absolutely. In a number of ways, I don't see how it couldn't be. I mean, first of all, my aesthetic comes from some of my favorite things and some of the most impactful things I read. And what you write is always hugely influenced by what you've read or seen. And I mean, such a weird kind of mishmash in my head of Shakespeare and Ibsen and Chekhov and Sam Beckett and David Mamet. I mean, there's so many different contrasting styles. They're all kind of like mixed up in my head somewhere. And Oscar Wilde, man, I love that guy. I like to draw upon a lot of different styles like that. The other thing is that, you know, as an actor, you spend a lot of time ruminating over background information about your character that will probably never see the light of day. So I'm used to really kind of digging in. And the key to acting is empathy and empathizing with the character that you're playing, understanding their point of view, where they're coming from. That's something that I always do as a writer, too, when I'm creating a character. I'm always coming from the place of, even if I fail sometimes, of doing everything I can to understand it from their perspective. Not pity, you know, but empathy, which is a hugely different thing. So I would say that that's a lot of my focus as a writer. I first go to the character. I first go to what they want. Because at the end of the day, that's what all acting is. You know, if you go to like Stanislavski or any sort of method acting, when it comes down to it, you can't really play an emotion. What you can play is a desire, is what they want, what they are trying to achieve. And the rest, you know, if done committedly, kind of just falls into place. So that's always where I'm coming from. What does every character in the scene want at any given moment? That's always what I'm asking myself. And hopefully that makes for very active and involving storytelling.
I would say so, yeah.
One of my favorite questions to ask authors is how they come up with the names for their characters. For some reason, I have this thing about names. And pretty much every interview I have to ask. So how do you come up with the names for your characters?
Not with much science. They kind of come to me or not. There are a few times when the name for a character is really important to me. I'm trying to think of anyone in Struts and Frets. I mean, obviously, Gen 5 is such a distinct character.
Yeah, definitely.
And that one just came from my own experience of having a lot of friends named Jennifer and just thinking, like, how many Jens can there be? So I started, like, making things up, and I was like, what about Furry or Niffer? No. You know, like, you wouldn't want to call a girl that. So I thought, well, you know, if you're going to avoid that, what could you do? And so I started playing around with the idea of Gen 5, which also sounded kind of like kick-ass combat ninja, really, which is what she is. You know, it sounds like an action hero name. So, and she kind of envisions herself in her own way of being like an action hero. So that was definitely a really specific choice. But for the most part, the other character names just kind of came to me.
Do you think that would be different if you were writing like a historical fiction or something like that?
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, for Misfit, it's completely different because the main character, her name is Yael, which is a really theology dork reference to a very small, obscure passage in the Old Testament, in the Book of Judges. You know, people are like, really? Yael? Like, that's your protagonist's name? It looks a little weird on paper. It's spelled J-A-E-L. But I just had to go to the mat on that one because it's just such a perfect name for her. And I'm bringing in a lot of mythology for Misfit, and so I'm actually pulling in actual... There's demons in Misfit, lots of demons. And so I got the old roll call of demons found in The Witchhammer and other charming classic tomes. And so I was actually pulling in real demon names and real god and goddess names and that kind of thing. And there's something interesting with names and how they evolve. You can almost see them from language to language, like the goddess Astarte versus Aphrodite versus Astartes. And you know, I mean, you can kind of see the evolution. And when you look at who these goddesses are, they're all kind of the same person, you know, like just different pronunciations or different spellings or slight variations on the same name. And so that was a really conscious choice on my part in playing with some of that stuff in Misfit. So in Misfit, names are a very different kind of, much more thought out deal.
Wow. That's fascinating. And of course, we really want to know more about Misfit. And what might you be willing to share with our listeners?
Basically, the story of Misfit is this girl, Yael Thompson, and she's a sophomore high school student, and she's had a pretty rough life. You know, she's a super strict father who never lets her date. She's, like, never even kissed a boy, and he's always moving her from place to place. She switches schools, like, every 2 years, so it's really hard for her to make friends. And her father is probably so uptight because he used to be a monk. And the other reason he's probably so uptight is because her mother, who is deceased, was a demoness. And which makes Yael, of course, half demon. So that's pretty complicated. And she goes to Catholic school.
Gee, a demon in Catholic school.
Yeah, yeah. So she has to try to keep this secret. For all outward appearances, she appears to be a normal high school girl with just this kind of really embarrassing lineage. Until her 16th birthday, when her father gives her this gift that kind of unlocks everything. And, you know, things start to kind of go crazy for her. That's pretty much what I would have got so far. How does that sound?
I can't wait to read it.
All right, good answer. There's actually romance in it, of course. There's actually this skater boy math genius guy that she's in love with. And he ends up being pretty instrumental in how things work out. So,
all right, so you told us a little bit about Misfit. Mm-hmm. Which book was harder to write for you, Struts and Frets or Misfit?
That's kind of apples and oranges. I mean, overall, Misfit was way harder to write. There was a lot, just tons and tons of research involved. I've always been pretty fixated on theology and anthropology and that kind of stuff. I'm a huge fan of Joseph Campbell and the kind of myth cycle and everything like that. And I went to 12 years of Catholic school, so I have the proper background. So I've always taken a huge interest in theology. And I was, you know, as one is wont to do, I was reading this list of demon names. And no, it was a different project. I was kind of focused on the time. Uh-huh. It was a short story that was published in Bane's Universe, which was a little online zine, which is really cool. I was in the same issue as Gene Wolfe, which was like, oh, wow. So excited. Anyway, so I was looking at this stuff and I happened to notice that there was a name in the roll calls of hell for Dagon. And now Dagon, it kind of rang a bell, and I went back and looked in the Old Testament, and Dagon was, among other things, the god of the Philistines, right? He was the guy that, like, when the Philistines were the ones who stole the Ark of the Covenant from the Hebrews and everything like that, and then then they put it in their temple, and then when they came back in, they heard this loud crash, and all of a sudden the statue of their god, Dagon, had been knocked to the ground and its hands broken off and, you know, all this stuff. And they were like, whoa, get this thing out of here. And then later on, Dagon reappears in the story of Samson. It was actually in the temple of Dagon that Samson brought the house down, literally. And so, you know, Dagon was kind of a big deal. He was god of the Philistines and all that kind of stuff. And then in hell, though, there's like this list of demons, and one of them is named Dagon, Baker of Hell. You know, and like, how do you go from like God of the Philistines to like Baker of Hell? That's quite a demotion, you know what I mean? like that's gotta suck. And so Dagon is actually a character in Misfit who is definitely struggling with his demotion. This was a classic kind of Catholic Church plot that they did, is they would go into an area and they'd say, okay, you know, this religion that you believe, yeah, you're kind of right, but the difference is you got the names all wrong. It wasn't really, you know, this goddess or that, you know, it was actually the Virgin Mary, or it wasn't that god, it was actually Saint so-and-so. And they did that like all the time. That's how they became so popular so quickly. And they just swap out names and left everyone to continue on. And so you see all of these, what ends up being demons or sometimes even saints, coming from what were genuinely once upon a time religious figures. And I've always kind of thought, like, what would if that had happened literally? So that's what Misfit is sort of playing with a lot, that kind of thing.
And in high school, too. Yes. Wow. Yeah.
Plus, there's lots of fun stuff you can do in a Catholic school, especially with a demon girl. And that's what I tried to balance there. There's like the high concept stuff of like the mythology and all that stuff. But then there's just this girl who, you know, her mother was a succubus and she has these like succubus powers and she's like, I don't want any of this. And, you know, it just makes her embarrassed. And high school is often about that, you know. She's going through these changes, much like, you know, kids in high school are going through changes. And so there's a lot of hopefully fun stuff going on there with that.
It's a real big contrast, it seems, between the two books.
Yeah, my publisher was a little freaked out about it, I'll be honest. But fortunately, she's really super cool lady and was like, you know what, it's a great book. And so we're just going to do it.
Going back into the past, yes, the past. Struts and Frets. I was thinking about music in this book, mm-hmm. and it's so awesome that Sammy and his grandfather can relate to each other through music the way they do, even though they have totally different tastes. We were wondering, is there a current band maybe that they both might like?
Yeah, I would say that there's a couple of musicians who kind of tend to span long time periods. The one that comes to mind immediately would be Tom Waits. I mean, man, the guy's been around since like the early 70s, and he's had so many shifts and changes and evolutions. I mean, if you wanted to like chart out an amazing artist's life, that guy is just blows my mind. And, you know, and there's that early kind of more jazzy, loungy stuff, and definitely Sammy's grandfather would enjoy a lot of that stuff. You know, edgy, but still kind of traditional in a kind of a classic jazz way. Whereas the later stuff, it's kind of the reverse of most musicians, where frankly they were at their peak when they were usually totally just wasted on drugs or alcohol or just like a mess. It was when they were there at their height of their genius, unfortunately. But with Tom Waits, it was the opposite. After he got sober, he became this just amazing, groundbreaking, avant-garde, just totally nobody else does what he does, kind of, and certainly wasn't doing it when he started doing it. You look at, like, Bone Machine, like, what an album. It just doesn't get any better than that. And I think Sammy would really appreciate the kind of later, edgier stuff. So I would say that, yeah, he would be one that they could both appreciate.
Related to that, we love that your website lists bands and songs that Sammy would love. And we know that you like Gogol Bordello. So which of their songs do you think Sammy might like?
There's so many to choose from. Pretty prolific band. I would probably say Tribal Connections would be the most evocative of the spirit of Struts and Frets, certainly. Like, at that time in his life, that story, or that song, well, the story within the song, I'm going to take it to community, and we'll go, what's that other great line in it? It's going to turn frustration into inspiration. Like, that alone could be Sammy's mantra right there, you know. This is just a great song. So, I go now. It's my final answer.
Okay.
Where I was stopping by just for a drink, I meet a brother from Tribal Connection, and together we began to sing. We're gonna turn frustration into inspiration.
Whatever demons are there, we're gonna set them free.
Such is the method of Tribal Connection, of our fun-loving, restless breed.
I wanna walk this earth like it is mine, and so is everyone in our fun-loving tribe. Come on, man, is that real so much to ask? From all these goddamn Nazi feodals. But I'm gonna take it to community, 'cause I want everyone to see there never was. Should be coming out of every car. There is a silence all over downtown. Only the intersection semi-alive. Outskirts are sedate. Me gone.
The other thing that I thought was really moving about the book is how music helps his grandfather to remember himself somewhat. Mm-hmm. When his mind is slipping away, mm-hmm. and how they're sharing that connection. It's like a sharing of love, the sharing of music. And I wondered how much research you've done on art or music in older people or in people who have mental illness in some way.
The thing is, you know, we talked earlier this evening about what was harder to write, Misfit or Struts and Frets.
Right.
And whilst Misfit was more complex to write, Struts and Frets was a really personal book for me. And definitely a lot of Sammy's experience with his grandfather is similar to my own experience with my grandfather, who did have Alzheimer's. And man, I mean, it's pretty tough. A friend of mine is a music therapist, and that's what she does. She goes to hospice and assisted living facilities and that kind of stuff and tries to work with these folks who are really struggling to hold on to whatever they can. My own grandfather, like, I remember that sad moment when he stopped realizing that his piano was out of tune. Like, and you were just kind of like, how can you not hear that, you know? So those kind of moments were really tough. But the thing is it's not... You know, Alzheimer's and that kind of stuff, and this is, once again, me drawing from my own personal experience, there are moments in the book where Gramps remembers himself, kind of surfaces. Yeah. The person that you meet at the beginning of the book comes back for short periods, and that was very much my own experience with my grandfather. He was pretty far gone by this point and would often get confused and panicked and become a bit unmanageable. But he'd always been a lifelong fan of the Lord of the Rings books. And you know, I liked the Lord of the Rings books mostly because he liked them. They're a little rigid for my taste. I loved them because he loved them. And so when the first one came out, he was still alive. And I said, oh, I'm going to take him to see it. I'm going to take him to see the movie. And everyone was like, oh, you're nuts. He's going to hate it. He's not going to know what's going on. Oh, it's going to end in disaster. And I was like, yeah, well, thanks for your support. I'm taking him anyway. And I took him, and it was really hard at first. Walking into the movie theater, you got really nervous, really anxious, and I'm like, calm down. What are we doing here? Why are we here? You know, that kind of stuff. And he was really getting agitated towards the end of the previews. And then finally, though, the movie starts. And as soon as that kind of opening voiceover kicks in, it was like he just kind of locked in, you know, and he was suddenly there and was absolutely quiet and peaceful for the entire movie. And then afterwards, we're watching the credits roll, and I turned to my son, Poppy. I said, so what did you think of that movie? And he says, it was terrible. It was absolutely awful. There's no way Frodo would have done something like, you know, but... He was able to actually explain to me why he thought it was awful. And then we went home, and he pulls out his big leather-bound gold-leaf copy of Lord of the Rings, and he's, like, paging through and showing people on the maps, the inserted maps. Oh, well, you know, in the movie, they did this, but in the book, they skipped that whole part where, you know, and all this stuff. And he was himself for a few hours, for a night, you know, and you could see him basking in it and surfacing, you know, the him that I knew growing up, you know, because ultimately what Alzheimer's and other kind of dementia things towards the end, what they do is they rob you of your memories of that person. You're watching that person devolve in front of your eyes. And by the time they pass away, it's hard to remember the times before they were completely insane, you know? So you really have to strive to maintain some memory of what they used to be. Wow. And it's not easy. And it's definitely something that, you know, I struggle with, and it's definitely something that Sammy struggles with in the book.
So, moving on from that, I don't know, how do you transition from that?
Yeah.
A joke.
So now that you have more than one book out in the world, does being an author get easier as you have more and more books out? Or does it get harder? Or is it different than you thought it would be?
Well, you know, in some ways it's easier. The actual writing, I think, I don't want to say it gets easier with each book. It definitely does not. But you begin to panic less when it gets hard. You know, you're like, ah, this is the part where I suck. Okay. But yeah, there's always a part in the middle where I just totally suck. And I have no idea what I'm doing. And I doubt the entire project. And I think to myself, I can't do this. There's no way I could do it. I'd write a book. What are you kidding me? You know, but I've done enough now that I understand that that's actually a normal part of the process. For me, anyway, it is just that at a certain point in the middle, I'll get totally stuck and hate everything. And that's okay. I just don't get freaked out about it. I'm just like, okay, all right. The squishy middle, that's where I am. I need to keep plowing through it. Come back and fix it in revision. And so in that sense, it gets easier because you're getting a little more confident in your process, if nothing else. The complicated part is there's this whole other new layer to the job of writing, which is not actually writing. It's all of the expected things that go around with it. Do you have a blog? Are you on Twitter? Are you connecting with fans? And are you connecting with readers? And are you connecting with libraries? And not to say that this is in any way unpleasant, because let me tell you, I love this stuff. I eat this stuff up. I absolutely love talking to people about books and reading and creativity and art and all that cool stuff. Man, I'd do that all day if I could. But I didn't expect it to be so time-consuming and to have a real push-pull with actually getting writing done. You have to set limits on it, because otherwise your writing time just evaporates. You know, I mean, there's already only so much time in the day, and then you've got all these additional responsibilities. That's the harder part, is managing all of that. Then also you have to start thinking, you know, these are kind of business terms and these business ways, you know, like, will there be a sequel to Misfit? Well, I hope so. I've thought of one. But can I write it yet? Well, no, not really, because if my publisher doesn't want to buy it, who else would want to buy the second book? And these are unglamorous things to think about, you know. As soon as you introduce money, or as soon as you bring your art to a commodity level, things change. And you can rail against that all you want. It just does. And so you have to decide where you stand on things. You have to make those business decisions for yourself and treat yourself with a certain amount of professional respect.
Yeah, that's interesting.
It's pretty heavy stuff, yeah. Fortunately, though, particularly the young adult publishing community, I don't know about outside of YA, but the YA community has been incredibly supportive. So many people who have been mentoring me and guiding me and helping me along the way. And I could say, oh, I'll never repay them, but how I try to repay them is then paying it forward with other folks who are figuring stuff out for the first time.
And I think you alluded to this a little bit earlier, too, when you were talking about how kind of authors in their ivory towers.
Yes.
I feel like that myth has almost been like debunked now, because so many authors are so accessible to a point.
Yes.
You know,
yeah,
is that different than what you expected it to be as well?
There's definitely a weird moment where, you know, because I've been on Twitter pretty much since it first came out, like back when it wasn't cool. So I've been tweeting for some time, and there was kind of a weird moment where I posted some tweet, and all of a sudden, that tweet just blew up, and it was retweeted 50, 60 times, which was kind of jarring for me, because I expected to maybe get like a chuckle from Sandra Mitchell or something. And all of a sudden, there's like tons of people going, oh, this is hilarious. And you go, oh, yeah, wow. Within a certain community, like, people pay attention to things that I say now, which is kind of a weird thing. And it just makes me laugh, really. But yeah, and that was really, it took some adjusting. I actually pulled back a lot for a little while participating online, because I didn't know where my lines were, you know, what I was willing to share personally. You know, should I be posting pictures of my kids? Gosh, they're cute, but when does that get weird? Or does it get weird? You know, does it matter? Neil Gaiman posts pictures of his kids all the time. Why can't I, you know? That's my general rule. If Neil Gaiman do it, I can do it too. I'm only sort of joking about that. as an author, then you have to really think about these things, about what am I going to share? How am I going to share it, you know? Like, what do I want of my personal life out there? Because some people are paying attention for reasons that I don't know. And I think that it's definitely debunked the whole ivory tower concept, you know, when best-selling authors are like, so my plumbing's broken again, you know?
Yeah.
So ultimately, I think it's a good thing. Hopefully people see that there is no separation between writers and readers, really. I mean, we're all readers, right? And to a certain extent, we're all writers, just a little more fixated on it than others. But at the same time, I do think that we all need to be kind of aware of giving our own sacred and personal space, you know, like, and kind of keeping that close, you know what I mean? Like, don't give it all away, because then you end up kind of feeling a little adrift.
Gee, that was awesome. I feel like I've learned a great deal. So I just wanted to ask you one of my standard questions. This will be my last one. And I just wondered what advice you might have for young people who want to be creative or possibly to write. What would you advise them?
Well, I think that at the end of the day, at the very beginning, we were talking about how writing is a verb, not a noun. And I think that the best and most important thing you can do, if you want to be a writer, definitely the best and most important thing to do is to write a lot, and, you know, and then read a lot, and then write a lot, and then read a lot, and just keep, you know, and repeat and repeat. But I think that also, I'm kind of a militant creation person, I guess, in a way. Like, I believe that the act of being creative is not just something one does for fun on your nights off or whatever. If you're serious about it and you want to make a real study of it, you have to kind of imbue your entire life with it. The guy who wrote Clockers, what's his name? Richard Price, I think. He did a great interview on Bookworm, which is a great podcast if you've never read it or listened to it. Michael Silverblatt, KCRW. The guy has this amazing ability to verbalize an author's intent way better than any author ever could. And they kind of sit there on air being like, how do you do that? You know, he's just an incredible guy. And he had Richard Price on, and Richard Price, oh man, like, if I could just bottle up what he said, it was just incredible. And he talks about the job of a writer, of any artist, is to be constantly in a state of falling in love with life, that you have to be constantly discovering, as if for the first time, everything that happens to you, everything you see around you. And if you do that kind of wholeheartedly and passionately, then all that's left to do is report back, to receive, and then just kind of turn it around from your own perspective. So I think that living life that way is pretty much the goal of any sort of artist, I think, for me anyway. But, you know, these are things that don't come immediately. These are things you practice doing by reading and writing or creating or, you know, just doing it and not, you know, just shut up and write, basically. It's kind of how I tend to proceed, I guess.
Thank you so much.
Yes, I think that's a great place to end our questions.
Awesome.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed our interview with John Scovron as much as we did. And John actually has a wonderful new book coming out in fall of 2013 called Man Made Boy, which will feature monsters, Broadway, and a touch of romance as well. And it sounds really, really great. If you're interested in finding out more about it or his other works or collaborations, definitely check out his website, which is johnscovron.com. That's johnscovron.com. And if you want to check out any of his books or anything else, there's definitely one place you should go.
Kids, there's a really cool place you can be. It's a lot of fun, yeah, you will see. You can learn a lot about the world that we living in, the public library. The library, the library. It's a place where books are free. The library.
the library. It's a lot better than watching TV.
You better believe it.
Sections about almost everything. You'll always find something you're interested in. Plate tectonics or embroidery. Michael Portillo or the banyan tree. The library.
We'd like to thank all of our musicians today. The Iliad for our opening song. Gogo Bordello for that awesome song Tribal Connection. Tom Waits. And finally, Cursor Minor for the library song. And we'd be happy to see you either in the actual library or online at any time. Our next interview is going to be with Mike Mullen, whose novel Ashfall has won a number of awards and distinctions. And he's a really great and funny guy, so definitely check it out. And we'll see you then. Bye for now.